Hello?
One second.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Devashisda, we can. I can hear you, and if you're ready, I'll add the others as well.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Actually, it's a little faint, fainter than usual.
Now?
Yeah, now it's much better.
Okay, good.
Okay. Hello everyone. I think I've added everybody I see, and I'll keep looking, and if I find anyone online, add them back. I'll add them again. But meanwhile, Devashisda is online, and we can get going. Hello, Devashisda?
Yeah, Sean.
Yeah.
Okay, so last time we completed that last chapter, the second chapter. One second, let me find the right page, hold on.
On the PDF, the third chapter is on page 380.
Yeah, but I want to go back a little bit and look at that last chapter which we finished. Because the last class, we actually finished it. And I want to cover that area because a number of people were not present and we were sort of hurrying through it a little bit. Because that last, I think we had we did the last 1, 2, 3, and 4 paragraphs, last 4 paragraphs of the last chapter. And they really wrapped up that chapter in terms of experience, the conditions of experience, of our experience, and connected them to what he was talking about. Basically, Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti, Shakti. And trying to show, as he says, one problem still remains to be solved. And it's the problem of the non-manifest and the manifestation. So there he looks at the manifestation as being conditioned by time and place. It says call failed. Okay, anyway, that's okay. So, as the conditions of time and space, so he's looking at whether these conditions are conceptual only or whether they have a reality, whether they are real outside of conceptual realities. And if you remember, he has earlier pointed to some of the operations of Shakti in Brahman you look at it, Maya and Brahman, or Shakti on Ishvara, or Prakriti in itself, with the observation of Purusha. And there, the operations of Brahman that he has discussed have to do with selectivity, that is, Brahman can, out of its infinity, it can select to present itself in certain ways and put other things behind, as it were. And another feature that it talks about is exclusive concentration. In other words, even among the selectivity, the way in which it presents itself, it can focus its attention on a certain point to the exclusion of others, both in space and in time. And it is properties of this kind that allow it to have an individualized experience, which is really a what one might call an atomized experience in space, and which is the objective atomization, and also an atomized experience in time, which is the subjective atomization. The fact that it can view its reality in a kind of a manner as if it moves from moment to moment and is bounded by appearances and disappearances. These appearances and disappearances are fuzzy because, as a matter of fact, it contains the infinity which is around it or behind it, and the infinity that is in front of it as its, you know, sort of backdrop or background and foreground. You see, so these are present, but at the same time, they are subordinated and put behind. So out of this, he returns to this without really invoking that part of the chapter in his discussion of time and space. And to say that time and space are real, they're not really conceptual. They may have a conceptual component, but they are not created by our minds. This is a problem of philosophy, which most people, you know, philosophers tend to solve by making time and space into constructs of the mind or of living things, or they're subject to our experience, as it were. And in analyzing that, he gives it a treatment which is similar to that of the last chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, which is the chapter on the triple time vision. And so I want to just draw your attention to this. And so in this particular, I mean, the fourth paragraph from this important part where he deals with this, the paragraph that begins, "In any case, if spirit is a fundamental reality, time and space must either be conceptive conditions under which the spirit sees its own movement of energy, or else they must be fundamental conditions of the spirit itself, which assume a different appearance or status according to the status of consciousness in which they manifest." And he is going to put himself on the second condition. So one salient point in that paragraph that he makes is this part here, where he is looking at the objectivity and subjectivity respectively of space and time. And he says, "It would seem as if time had no objective reality, but depends on whatever conditions may be established by action of consciousness in its relation to status and motion of being. Time would seem to be purely subjective, but in fact, space also would appear by the mutual relation of mind space and matter space to be subjective. This mutuality by which mind and matter are entangled in space. In other words, both are the original spiritual extension, but it is rendered by mind in its purity into a subjective mind field, and by sense mind into an objective field of sense perception." So it is in this way that we find that mind and sense mind, mind which is conceptive mind and sense mind, play their role in the subjectivity of space, you see. So he says subjectivity and objectivity are only two sides of one consciousness. And the cardinal fact is that any given time or space, or any given time-space as a whole, is a status of being in which there is a movement of the consciousness and force of the being, a movement that creates or manifests events and happenings. It is the relation of the consciousness that sees and the force that formulates the happenings, a relation inherent in the status which determines the sense of time and creates our awareness of time movement, time relation, time measure. Its fundamental truth, the original status of time behind all its variations, it is nothing else than the eternity of the eternal. Just as the fundamental truth of space, the original sense of its reality, is the infinity of the infinite. So again, this is really a question of the relation between Brahman and Maya, or of Ishvara and Shakti, that gives this particular form to the eternal and the infinite. Then he points to this quadruple status, which is similar to the what he discusses in the last chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, that our experience of time has got this the four statuses that operate at the same simultaneously in supermind. But we are unfortunately subject to these statuses and experience only the last and fourth of these statuses. And so I draw your attention to that too. He first starts by saying three states of consciousness, but in fact specifies one of them a little more and makes it four. He says the being can have three different states of its consciousness with regard to its own eternity. The first is that in which there is the immobile status of the self in its essential existence, self-absorbed or self-conscious, but in either case without development of consciousness in movement or happening. So this is what we distinguish as its timeless eternity. If we think of this, we can think about it as a kind of point. It has no representation even as space, either self-absorbed or self-conscious. In other words, it is a pure self-consciousness, but not self-extended. It is intrinsic self-consciousness, and it is in a certain poise, unmanifest in that sense. The second is its whole consciousness of the successive relations of all things belonging to a destined or an actually proceeding manifestation, in which what we call past, present and future stand together as if in a map or settled design, or very much as an artist or painter or architect might hold all the details of his work viewed as a whole, intended or reviewed in his mind, or arranged in a plan for execution. Philosophers have called this the status of time as space. In other words, it is all time coexisting in a certain space that has been mapped out, this design, as he says. So this is already a ideational selection, a selection by idea. This is real idea of supermind that has organized the infinity in a certain arrangement in terms of past, present and future, which it is in a certain status of its self perception able to view transcendentally and statically. Then we find third, which is actually what he divides into two more. Then map view, this is the second one, is the stable status or simultaneous integrality of time. This seeing of time is not at all part of our normal awareness of events as they happen, though our view of the past, because it is already known, can be regarded in the whole, may put on something of this character. In other words, we may write histories. In a history, we are looking at the whole of the past, our own past, or some past of some nation, or of humanity, or of the earth, in a certain kind of continuous narration form. But we know that this consciousness exists because it is possible in an exceptional state to enter into it and see things from the viewpoint of this simultaneity of time vision. And here Sri Aurobindo is using a form of argumentation which he uses off and on, which is that he's making an appeal to subjective experience. He's saying that human experience gives this in its rarer possibilities, but it is possible. People have experienced it. And we may say that this experience has its degrees. And when Sri Aurobindo in the seven quartets is recording what he calls Trikal Darshan, Trikal Drishti, he is using something of this kind at its different degrees, so that the question of clairvoyance, or the question of prophecy, or of divination, all these come into the purview of this experience. In each of these, we contact something which is already a prevision of a greater span of time, not just out of a mental logic or some kind of hunch, but something which purifies itself in greater degrees and approaches this second kind of self-vision of Brahman. Then he says, the third status is that of a processive movement of consciousness force, and its successive working out of what has been seen by it in the static vision of the eternal. This is the time movement. So here again, what some of those operations of Brahman he was talking about, one of them was this, that it can simultaneously view itself in different ways, and these views can coexist because they are simultaneous. So here is the third such view, the view of the processive movement. It is essentially one in itself, one and indivisible, in which nothing is divided. It is self-conscious and or self-absorbed. It is also self-extended as a possibility of a certain arrangement. And thirdly, it is that arrangement that is actually working itself out in process, or it is that arrangement that knows itself as something that is working itself out as a movement, as a process. And so these three are the same thing, but they are experienced simultaneously as three forms of self-knowledge. And that's what gives supermind its sense of time and space, for that matter. So the third status is that this is the time movement, but it is in one and the same eternity that this triple status exists and the movement takes place. This third, the time eternity, is the only one that we experience. We are subject to it. We experience ourselves as driven by time. We have no control over the past, and the future is something that we have to accept. While, as a matter of fact, it is from a certain point of view of our own consciousness, a certain kind of self-choice of self-arrangement that is being viewed both as a consciousness that is free of it and a consciousness that has viewed itself as it and is following its own view. That's all that it's doing. It sees itself through a certain idea and follows that view. They are not this time, but it's one and the same eternity. And this triple status exists, that this triple status and the movement takes place. So, this pure existence of this status and its existence as movement, as sequence or process, are not really two eternities, one an eternity of status, another an eternity of movement, but there are different statuses or positions taken by consciousness with regard to the one eternity. And now he'll reiterate it in almost in a quadruple form. For it can see the whole time development from outside or from above the movement. It can take a stable position within the movement and see the before and the after in a fixed, determined or destined succession. Or it can take instead a mobile position in the movement, itself move with it from moment to moment, and see all that has happened receding back into the past, and all that has to happen coming towards it from the future. In this third way in which he is looking at it, he's pointing to the fact that there is also not just one point in time. We experience time as a certain point in time in which we are placed, but to supermind, it can look thus from any point in time. It can go back to a past and make that the present, or it can go into the future and make that the present, and the past is mapped to it as having gone behind and the future as being in front. And then the fourth one is it may concentrate on the moment it occupies and see nothing but what is in that moment and immediately around or behind it. That is more like our condition. And our condition still has a little bit of the third condition implicit in it, because we have a relationship with time which is larger, even in its mentation, in its conception, than, for example, that which forms of consciousness that are more subject to the sense mind are aware of. For example, animals are much closer to that fourth kind, where their concentration is focused on the immediate present, and it doesn't know what will happen in the next moment, and it forgets what happened in the past, except for the fact of what has become imminent in it in terms of learning and experience. But in supermind, these are all simultaneous. This is the point he's making. All these positions can be taken by the being of the infinite in a simultaneous vision or experience. It can see time from above and inside time, exceeding it and not within it. It can see the timeless develop the time movement without ceasing to be timeless. It can embrace the whole movement in a static and a dynamic vision, and put out at the same time something of itself into the time vision, into the moment vision. So these are the four statuses by which the supermind experiences. Time is what he is looking at here, but space is also inclusive over there, because it is the self-extension in which this whole time movement is occurring. So that, I just wanted to draw our attention to that, because it wasn't sufficiently clear last time. So I read that last part of that paragraph and we can move on to the next. To an infinite consciousness, such an integral simultaneity of vision and experience would be perfectly logical and consistent. All could be elements of a whole vision, capable of being closely related together in a harmonious arrangement, a multiplicity of view bringing out the unity of the thing seen, a diverse presentation of concomitant aspects of the one reality. If there can be the simultaneous multiplicity of self-presentation of the one reality, we see that there is no impossibility in the coexistence of a timeless eternal and a time eternity. It would be the same eternity viewed by a dual self-awareness, and there would be no opposition between them. It would be a correlation of two powers of the self-awareness of the infinite and eternal reality, a power of status and non-manifestation, a power of self-effecting action and movement and manifestation. Their simultaneity, however contradictory and difficult to reconcile it might seem, to our finite surface seeing, would be intrinsic and normal to the Maya or eternal self-knowledge and all knowledge of Brahman, the eternal infinite knowledge and wisdom power of the Ishvara, the consciousness force of the self-existent Satchidananda. So, in this way, Sri Aurobindo sees the bridging of that which is timeless and that which is in time. This is a very profound problem in philosophy. And most of the Indian traditions before this have for this reason tried to attempt this problem by creating a sort of spurious division between them. By either privileging, by privileging the status and the non-manifestation. By pointing to the fact that this movement in time is a subjection because it is a false conception. If we change the conception and if we change the conditions of that entrapment or subjection, then we'll find that we'll experience the status and the non-manifestation. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that what we need to do is not just change the conception and this kind of movement out of time into the timeless, but we need to see the or enter a certain consciousness in which the simultaneity of the timeless and the time movement are experienced as very operations of self-consciousness. The various self-perceptions of Brahman or of Ishvara, the various self-manifestations.
So, Devaruchita,
yeah.
As this chapter is concerned, like the big, you know, the new idea or the big innovation, so to say, from Sri Aurobindo is that as he presents the problem, he solved it by saying that in the Brahman, all of them are simultaneously possible. Whereas with the, in the past, all the philosophers and all the experiences always, you know, they kind of arbitrarily privileged one over the other. But his kind of genius solution to that is that he says that in the experience of the Brahman, it's basically possible to experience all of them together, and the Brahman sees them all together. Would you say that's his big, like the original thing that he brings in this chapter as far as the problems he's presented are concerned?
That is certainly one of the original ideas he brings in, but that is the last major idea. The major idea over here, there are several. One of them, the major one that gives its name to the chapter, is to see these three relations. Actually, to posit the one and the two to be co-extensive. In other words, in all realities of Brahman, it is at once one and two. And this two-ness of the Brahman is what ultimately, as soon as there are two radical infinities, we can talk about a plural field. It immediately pluralizes and relativizes the field. So there is the totally relative infinite field of infinite possibilities, and there is the one, and the two are the same. The two are one. And how do they operate so that they are experienced at the same time? That is the question. And so he's answering this question in terms of these three statuses of two-ness, Brahman, Maya, Ishvara, Shakti, and Purusha, Prakriti, which are occurring at three different levels. We may say Brahman, Maya is occurring in the transcendent, in Satchidananda and in Vijnana, Ishvara Shakti is occurring in Vijnana or supermind of Vidya, and Purusha Prakriti is occurring at the level of Avidya. So these are all statuses of the same self-division of the one, looking at itself as one and two at the same time. And then the other major idea is what we just discussed. And the innovation is not only that, yeah, certainly that is the innovation, as you mentioned, but it is also a recognition, implicit recognition of the fact that the reason why people in the past have tended to see these as two different realities within which we have to choose is that they have subjected Brahman to the mind. In other words, the property of the mind, which sees, non-contradiction as essential, and then tries to say that the timeless and the time and the reality in time are contradictories, therefore they cannot exist, is really a subjection of Brahman to the law of mind.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other hand, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is not only that Brahman can lie outside the law of mind, but that there can be such a law which is coherent at the same time. It's not just incoherent and irrational. It is coherent. It is another kind of operation of simultaneity, but it is a form of consciousness, a logic of the infinite, which is very possible not only to the Brahman itself, but to us, since what he is pointing out is that we could change our consciousness and experience this. I think this is a very major point. He's saying that there is a plane of consciousness which in which we do not dwell, but which we can conceptualize, and which is the mind of Brahman, supermind, in which this is the normal form of experience. And that we could have that form of experience. In having that form of experience, we know reality as the divine knows reality, in other words. And we understand the true relation between the timeless and time, the one and the infinite, that which is unmanifest and the manifestation.
Thank you, Devashista. Very useful.
One quick question. It seems that Sri Aurobindo is talking about our ability to have the experience of the potential of developing our consciousness as supermind, to have this experience. Is this also a breakthrough or a different approach than anyone else talking about becoming able to have this experience in order to validate these truths? Or is, I know it's different in the Indian tradition, is it just different period across East-West thought?
It is difficult for me to say. I'm not really sure of all the literature. There have been conceptually in the whole field of spiritual philosophy many very luminous ideas that have been presented. So I'm not entirely sure to what extent any philosophy has tried to posit the possibility of this kind of a consciousness of simultaneity, in which the statuses of what he calls here non-being and the status of still reality, unchanging eternity, and the status of a certain kind of a divided reality, both in time and place, are seen to be one. But the attempt has been made. It is not that the attempt has not been made. There are people who have tried to address this and to different degrees. I just don't think, I mean, say for example, the attempt made by Madhyamika Buddhism, or even in its own way by Yogacara Buddhism, to say that Nirvana and Samsara are the same, you know, the identity of Nirvana and Samsara. What does that mean? In its, if we really stretch that idea to its full potency, it might end up being something like this. But was it really stretched to its full potency? Was it made into a goal for human yogis? Then the other traditions in India include Kashmir Shaivism, of which Sri Aurobindo felt that they were in many ways coming close to what he had to say. And also the Siddha traditions of Tamil Nadu, the Shaivite Siddha traditions. It's possible that they were trying to approach something of this kind, but I'm not sure to what extent and in what way they actually solved these problems, because they have not become, dominant, and they have not left a legacy which is strong enough for us to be able to draw on at this time.
Thank you, Devish.
I was just curious about the possibility of the interpenetration between these layers, meaning suppose if it is supposed that these different layers of consciousness are simultaneously existing, and there is a vision, integral vision of all at some point. But how about suppose a devotee, totally surrendered, and the divine responding, and the relationship and the divine intervention as a result from time to time. So I mean, also like another question, right, in relationship with that is coming to me, is that how do you define the relationship between the nature's law versus the law of grace, you know? So how do they fit in to this?
No, I think that's certainly a very important element in understanding what Sri Aurobindo is talking about here, which is what you're calling interpenetration. I'd say not only interpenetration, I'd say interrelation between these statuses of existence and consciousness. So indeed, you're absolutely right, and that is not only, as you said, it makes for intervention. It makes for the incursion of one of these kinds of self-perceptions into another of those kinds. So that is certainly something which is part of this reality. That's also an act of the Shakti. That's the part of the reason why Sri Aurobindo is saying the surrender to the Shakti is necessary, because we are stuck in the fourth movement. But to Shakti, there can be that intervention of grace by which we are made to bridge this movement with a higher movement, and we can be made to transform our experience. So the law, again, the same applies to what you call the law of statistics and the law of grace, which is, in a sense, when we talk about Purusha and Prakriti, we are talking about a reality or an experience of relation which is occurring within the avidya, or within the space created by drawing a curtain or a veil between the whole vision and the part vision, or the moment vision, as he calls it over here. So out of that relationship with that whole vision pushes us into what in today's language we call a transpersonal reality. We are no longer a personal being, but we are a transpersonal. In other words, our personal limits have become hazy due to the fact that a kind of a link has been established between two such statuses, due to a special operation of Shakti. And certainly, I think that is something which is an important dimension in thinking about how we may move from our present condition to that condition.
Debashish, yes. It seems that that there are experiences or activities or qualities of the consciousness force that are usually in the ordinary kind of experience or of time of ourselves, they're separate. Or they follow in a certain sequence. That you could have an experience, for example, of love and seeing as one, and not separate things, not divided by time, a simultaneous experience of those, or a simultaneous experience, for example, of absolute stillness and power, of so kind of a quality. And when those occur, something also radically happens with the sense of time. So just trying to take in what you said about that eternal time or whatever is one thing, but it's the consciousness that has these takes the different positions. And I think those different positions might occur by this simultaneity of these different qualities, the simultaneity of a certain action of the consciousness, like seeing and loving.
Absolutely. And as you remember in this chapter, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out that we can simultaneously experience different times. For example, even in a simple way, we can have a physical time where the body is related to other beings in a world which is driven by a clock and by the cycles of the seasons and by days and nights. While the mind can have a very different relationship and experience of time. So we do have in our same existence a number of these experiences. We can also have something a little more extraordinary, which is a little like what you were talking about, where one can experience, as it were, the active part of our being as going on by itself, an experience of prakriti, while there is another or static part of the being which stands outside and seems to experience a different kind of time, a time of stillness. So a time which is related to dynamic movement and a time of stillness can coexist. There can be simultaneous different experiences of time and of reality, of different ontologies at the same time. That also is subject to consciousness and its layers or levels. In other words, at our level, we may experience this simultaneity as two separate experiences that coexist. But we may also be able to experience these as two experiences that are not only coexistent, but that are under the control of a third and higher consciousness, which can, in a sense, interpenetrate them and put them in relation in special ways that we are not conscious of at this time. So this is the thing about rising from our level, in which we can experience actually certain extraordinary states, different forms of consciousness, but they can exist in relation to each other or separate from each other simultaneously. We can also have that same experience at a higher level of consciousness, in which we sense that it is at our control or command to have them simultaneously and still feel one in all these, or to bring them in relation in special ways.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure.
Devashish, actually,
yeah.
Did you see the movie Interstellar?
No, I haven't. Did you mention it sometime? Somebody was mentioning it. And I haven't, but if you think it's a good one to look at, maybe I will look at it.
Well, it's a very...
Has it got something like this happening in it?
Yeah, it's a very annoying movie, and there, it's just irritating. But some of the stuff in there, it seems to be that this might actually be... It's about time and going back and forward in time and seeing things in the past from two different points of view, and if you ever see it, maybe you can tell us what you think it means in terms of this chapter.
Sure. You know, like what you're talking, I haven't seen it, of course, but what you're talking about is one of these statuses, as he says, sort of like the third status, where Brahman can do that, of course. But again, it's not a subjection in the case of Brahman. It's another one of its self-experiences that coexists with the other self-experiences, that it can take that certain form.
Right. Thank you.
So if, you know, we think everybody feels we've put that chapter behind us, we can move on to chapter 3. I would suggest starting it from the beginning. If we read something before, we can reconsider it from the beginning. And after these two positing the conditions under which manifestation takes place in terms of determinations and in terms of the relations between the one and the many, he will now look at that from the viewpoint of the eternal and the individual. So he's laying first the conditions of cosmic experience, and then he's honing in on the specific experience that we have as individuals in this world. So I think we can move on to that chapter 3, book 2, part 1.
Sure. Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Okay. This is chapter 3. The eternal and the individual. He am I, Isha Upanishad, verse 16. It is an eternal portion of me that has become the living being in a world of living beings. The eye of knowledge sees the Lord abiding in the body and enjoying and going forth from it. Gita 15:7-10. Two birds beautiful of wing, friends and comrades, cling to a common tree, and one eats the sweet fruit. The other regards him and eats not. Where winged souls cry the discoveries of knowledge over their portion of immortality, there the Lord of all, the King of the world, took possession of me, he the wise, me the ignorant. Rig Veda, Roman numeral 1, 164, 20, 21. There is then a fundamental truth of existence, an omnipresent reality, omnipresent above the cosmic manifestation and in it, and immanent in each individual. There is also a dynamic power of the omnipresence, a creative or self-manifesting action of its infinite consciousness force. There is, as a phase or movement of the self-manifestation, a descent into an apparent material inconscience, an awakening of the individual out of the inconscience, and an evolution of his being into the spiritual and supramental consciousness and power of the reality, into his own universal and transcendent self and source of existence. It is on this foundation that we have to base our conception of a truth in our terrestrial being and the possibility of a divine life in material nature. There, our chief need is to discover the origin and nature of the ignorance which we see emerging out of the unconscious of matter or disclosing itself within a body of matter, and the nature of the knowledge that has to replace it, to understand, too, the process of nature's self-unfolding and the soul's recovery. For, in fact, the knowledge is there concealed in the ignorance itself. It has rather to be unveiled than acquired. It reveals itself rather than is learned by an inward and upward self-unfolding. But first, it will be convenient to meet and get out of the way one difficulty that inevitably arises, the difficulty of admitting that, even given the eminence of the divine in us, even given our individual consciousness as a vehicle of progressive evolutionary manifestation, the individual is in any sense eternal, or that there can be any persistence of individuality after liberation has been attained by unity and self-knowledge.
So, as we can see, what Sri Aurobindo has been dealing with so far are cosmic conditions. And he has put his weight on the side of the transcendental and the cosmic. As we saw, even with the analysis of time and space, it is not as conceptive realities subject to the individual that he is seeing these. Conditions of experience are conditions of reality. They are ontological, not psychological. So we find that it may be easy to suppose that Sri Aurobindo is going, in some sense, in a similar way to other schools of the East, particularly, that subordinate or in some sense, not subordinate, is maybe it's okay to subordinate, but maybe erase any reality of the individual. So, does the individual have any reality? We are saying, we've heard him say a number of things. We've heard him say, for example, that these are all the operations of Maya in Brahman. And he's not Maya in any pejorative sense, but Maya in a creative sense. So, Brahman has become this cosmos. Brahman has become every entity in this cosmos. Brahman's experience is the experience of this cosmos and of every entity in this cosmos. And this experience has got a number of qualities to it. And one of them, the special quality by which we experience things, is what he calls here the evolution of the ignorance. Brahman has plunged itself into a certain self-forgetting as one of the operations of its consciousness, and out of that and out of its self-fragmentation, it is re-emerging in a way in which it will repossess its integral truth. So this is a certain form of time experience of the Brahman. That particular form of time experience of the Brahman is what we experience as individuals who are subject to the evolution of the ignorance. But the question that he's asking over here is that if we describe it in these ways, what is the reality of the individual? Is there any reality to the individual? Is the individual just a temporary fiction of Brahman? And once that experience of integrality is reached, there is no need for it to continue. This has also been, of course, an old problem in Indian philosophy. In the Upanishads, if we really look at them, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out somewhere, there isn't a very clear, because Upanishads are a body of texts that have been written over a long period of time. There isn't a single aim. There are two aims that emerge. One aim is the aim of moksha, which is also sometimes, sort of formulated as a cessation of the cycle of rebirths. And the other aim is the aim of Jivan Mukti, which is formulated as a completely liberated existence within life, without necessarily positing anything about what will happen after this life. Are we going to return? Or are we, since everything has been achieved, are we going to disappear? In Buddhism, we find this notion coming into the idea of what Buddhists call the nirvana with remainder and the nirvana without remainder. In other words, the Buddha is supposed to have had the full achievement under the Bodhi tree, but then just retained a body for the remaining 35 years of his life, or 45, whichever is, the actual number of years. And then at the end of it, he gave up the life, after which there was nobody there, as if the Buddha disappeared. And if at all something of him remained, other schools like the Mahayana school say that is just because he is waiting for others to arrive at the same status. What will happen at that time? Presumably the need for the individual will disappear. So this has been a persistent problem, that it arises from the fact of accepting the ignorance as a temporary prison, a prison out of which we must emerge. And if we emerge out of that prison, what is the need for retaining the prison? And along with the notion of the prison, the form of the individual is treated as an imprisonment. So why should we have any individual left at all? This is the question. And this is the question that Sri Aurobindo is addressing in this particular chapter. And he foregrounds it in the very first paragraph.
Linda, would you like to read next?
You bet. All right. This is a difficulty of the logical reason and must be met by a larger and more Catholic enlightening reason. Or if it is a difficulty of spiritual experience, it can only be met by a wider resolving experience. It can indeed be met also by a dialectical battle, a logomachy of the logical mind, but that by itself is an artificial method, often a futile combat in the clouds and always inconclusive. Logical reasoning is useful and indispensable in its own field in order to give the mind a certain clearness, precision, and subtlety in dealing with its own ideas and word symbols, so that our perception of the truths which we arrive at by observation and experience, or which physically, psychologically, or spiritually we have seen, may be as little as possible obscured by the confusions of our average human intelligence, its proneness to take appearance for fact, its haste to be misled by partial truth, its exaggerated conclusions, its intellectual and emotional partialities, its incompetent bunglings in that linking of truth to truth by which alone we can arrive at a complete knowledge. We must have a clear, pure, subtle, and flexible mind in order that we may fall as little as possible into that ordinary mental habit of our kind, which turns truth itself into a purveyor of errors. That clarification, the habit of clear, logical reasoning, culminating in the method of metaphysical dialectics, does help to accomplish, and its part in the preparation of knowledge is therefore very great. But by itself, it cannot arrive either at the knowledge of the world or the knowledge of God, much less reconcile the lower and the higher realization. It is much more efficiently a guardian against error than a discoverer of truth, although by deduction from knowledge already acquired, it may happen upon new truths and indicate them for experience or for the higher and larger truth-seeing faculties to confirm. In the more subtle field of synthetical or unifying knowledge, the logical habit of mind may even become a stumbling block by the very faculty which gives it its peculiar use. For it is so accustomed to making distinctions and dwelling upon distinctions and working by distinctions that it is always a little at sea when distinctions have to be overridden and overpassed. Our object then in considering the difficulties of the normal mind when face to face with the experience of cosmic and transcendental unity by the individual must be solely to make more clear to ourselves, first, the origin of the difficulties and the escape from them, and by that, what is more important, the real nature of the unity at which we arrive, and of the culmination of the individual when he becomes one with all creatures and dwells in the oneness of the eternal.
So this is a very interesting kind of almost a methodological paragraph. And as we see, Sri Aurobindo sometimes opens a window upon his own kind of reasoning in this work. And so he's asking the question first as to how we address this question. And then he's giving two answers right in the beginning of the bat. The first one is that it's a difficulty of the logical reason. And as I pointed out earlier, we saw why people have chosen to give this kind of a view in the past, as one in which the individual must disappear because it is only a self-formation for some reason of the Brahman and not really reality. And on the other hand, he's saying over here that if that is the logical or whatever logical reason we have to see whether there may be a larger and more Catholic enlightening reason Now, this notion of taking a certain viewpoint, which has a certain reason or a assumption behind it, and probing it or testing it in such a way that makes it either stand or fail or modify itself according to a larger vision of things, a vision which is more empowering or fulfilling, integral, in, to use his language, is something that in modern times, in our times, in contemporary times, it forms a certain methodological standpoint that is known as constructive philosophy. Constructive philosophy means that we don't look, it starts with the assumption that anything that we can say about any standpoint is ultimately an interpretation. It's basically trying to look at what people have said and say, well, this is what they meant. So instead of going into a splitting hairs about what somebody meant, which we know really nothing about, one particular standpoint, the standpoint of constructive philosophy, is to turn a certain kind of reason upon other attitudes or logical standpoints so as to interpret them in a way conducive to a larger vision of things, a more integral vision of things. That's what makes it constructive, in a sense. A more holistic, more ethically empowering, more full of equality, etc., is a constructive way of looking. And he's talking in a way about that, that it must be met by a larger and more Catholic, and by Catholic he means inclusive, enlightening reason. Or if it is a difficulty of spiritual experience, and here he's pointing to the fact that it may not just be what we want, the knowledge that is arrived or derived from the vision of the mind, however large it may be, but the knowledge that may be conditioned by the possibilities of experience. Is this what spiritual experience tells us is the highest possibility, the possibility of the disappearance of the individual? If that is what the difficulty is, it can only be met by a wider resolving experience. It's only when we see the limitations of the experiences that people have told us with regard to the nature of truth that we can ask questions about whether there can be another kind of experience. This is very profound. And so we see how our existential makeup and our logical reason plays a part even in determining the experiences that are possible to us. It is in fact this kind of combination of existential need, logical mind and experience that made Sri Aurobindo not accept the initial experience of Nirvana that he had as final. In fact, he says at one place, if this is all there was to it, then it would leave me hugely dissatisfied. And a reality, a spiritual reality that left the world as it is, was felt by me to be distasteful. So this is it. Here he is getting a certain experience of liberation, but there is still a question of taste. And where is that taste coming from? It is coming out of his existential needs. Something has not been answered by this experience. So this is the point he's making. Even experience is not something that we should take for granted as a finality if there is something that is not answered in us. It can only be met by a wider resolving experience. Then the rest of the paragraph is about the place of the logical reasoning mind. And this part, interestingly, reads quite similar to, in some ways at least, to the argument that Socrates has with the Sophists in Greece. The Sophists are a group of professional philosophers. They reason for money, and they reason just to play the game of putting various viewpoints forward and challenging each other to either win or lose a logical game. And Socrates is saying, essentially, he kind of probes them through dialogue and ultimately gets them to admit the insufficiency of their position. For Socrates, where does truth lie? Truth lies, and as he's pointing out, there is a great utility to purifying the reasoning mind, and that is what logic does. Logic helps us as a purificatory mechanism for our subjective nature to arrive at clear perception. But there have to be other sources of understanding. And these sources of understanding can either be spiritual experience, where there is a certain access to reality at other levels of consciousness that give a different vision of things, a view of things. For Socrates, there are also sources of intuition, and he points to at least two major sources of intuition. One is memory, and this memory, which Plato kind of expounds on, has to do with the fact that there is a connection with the world of ideas, that we are, in fact, in his case, he says we have descended from a world of ideas, and that eternal home is where we came from.
Sorry, there seems to be a lot of noise.
Yeah, who has their mic on?
Slightly it was Rakesh, but I think he's switched it off now. We can continue.
Okay. So idea of memory as a source that can illumine or give a sort of clarity to the reason, ultimately is going back to what we call psychic memory, or the kind of experience of time that he has just talked about, a higher experience of time. That type of memory is something that connects us with that static vision of the idea. In fact, this is exactly what Plato is going to talk about. The ideas that he talks about are in fact real ideas, ideas that are living and which are behind the cosmos. So one can remember this, because ultimately we are not different from that. That has become us. So that's the reason why we can fall back on that. That's one of the arguments that he makes. And the other argument, as Sri Aurobindo has pointed out, made by Socrates, has to do exactly with the psychic being. He calls it the daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N. So it is by being open to the promptings of the innermost being that already knows, and that can show by its light, sometimes even irrationally, something which is irrefutable and which the reason then needs to wrap itself around. Reason has to be constructive around the vision of the daemon rather than the other way around. And so in a way, this argument that Sri Aurobindo is making is moving in that direction. And he is ultimately ending the paragraph by saying that the goal is what we must arrive at, and we must keep the aim of what we are trying to do in mind when we use our reason. And that is that we are trying to arrive at the real nature of the unity and of the culmination of the individual when he becomes one with all creatures and dwells in oneness of the eternal. Because this has been already posited as the goal. So if that is the case, then how do we understand the position of the individual?
So he's kind of set up the goals for us in the first paragraph. In the second paragraph, he's warning about how not to go about it, or the dangers of going about it via the dialectical approach, correct?
Yeah, quite right. So he has set up the goals even in the other two chapters.
Sure.
And so he's now pointing to, and as you're saying in the first paragraph, he has set it up, foregrounded it. He has pointed out what it is that he has told us about the operations of Brahman that have created ignorance and are making it evolve individually and cosmically, and what we need to understand from that. And then he's pointing to how we can go about it. What is the method? And he points in the first two sentences to two operations. One is the operation of a more inclusive reasoning, and the other is the operation of a more inclusive spiritual experience. The two have to go together as a more wider resolving experience. So we have to draw on these two powers and on the purification of the mind or of the logical faculty to ask the question and proceed with trying to find an answer, not just by putting a number of logical alternatives against each other as if we can arrive at convincing solutions that way.
Debashish, I want to thank you for what you said earlier, which was which really impressed me, and it was how Sri Aurobindo, even with the experience of nirvana, had that experience of existential need, which told him that it could not be it in terms of the whole. And when I ask myself what let him experience that existential need, or, and that's true not just for Sri Aurobindo but for us, is it the where Ananda is not yet? Is it where the bliss appears to be missing? Is that what then made him realize that there has to be some way where the individual, even though maybe logically we can't, that the individual does persist in some way?
Well, it could be that, again, the existential conditions will differ from person to person. But if there is an experience that we have, which seems to be very, almost overwhelming, yet, if there is something in the nature that has not been answered by it, we have to give value to that. In his case, it was not necessarily just the missing bliss or delight, but it was the fact that he started his journey both in politics as well as in yoga with a seeking for power. Now, note that he entered politics. As soon as he came back into India, he was looking for power to save this nation. And that's what he turned to yoga for. He looked to yoga as a means by which he could find some kind of shakti. What kind of shakti, we are not clear about, but he also may not have been clear about. But he thought there was something there. And that same goal is continuing in that statement that I made, where he's saying a realization which left the world as it is was felt by me to be almost distasteful. This is the actual quote. This is exactly what he says. So something which he has experienced, which is overwhelming, gives him a new vision of things, but at the same time, it leaves the world as it is. And something in his existential activist nature would not accept that. There was a distaste towards it. There was a feeling that this can't be it.
So are you saying, Debashish, it wasn't just the where the bliss was not, but it was a limitation on the consciousness force?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. In his case, exactly. That's what he felt, that there has to be more to the consciousness force. And that's what started revealing itself to him later when he went to the jail, and then further after he came out and went to Chandanagar and Pondicherry.
Thank you very much.
Devashish, when he says this problem can also be met by a dialectical battle, do you think he's talking about Hegel?
He says it can indeed be met also by a dialectical battle, but then he's saying that meeting it is not going to give an answer. And he may have Hegel a little in mind, but I personally feel he's thinking about the sophists, because they were also engaging in dialectical battle. And that's the reason why I talked about Socrates. It's very possible that with his background in early Greek philosophy, he's thinking of arguments of that kind.
Okay, thank you.
Dan Wood, would you like to read next?
Sure. Okay. The first difficulty for the reason is that it has always been accustomed to identify the individual self with the ego and to think of it as existing only by the limitations and exclusions of the ego. If that were so, then by the transcendence of the ego, the individual would abolish his own existence. Our end would be to disappear and dissolve into some universality of matter, life, mind, or spirit, or else some indeterminate from which our egoistic determinations of individuality have started. But what is this strongly separative self-existence that we call ego? It is nothing fundamentally real in itself, but only a practical construction of our consciousness devised to centralize the activities of nature in us. We perceive a formation of mental, physical, vital experience which distinguishes itself from the rest of being, and that is what we think of as ourselves in nature, this individualization of being in becoming. We then proceed to conceive of ourselves as something which has thus individualized itself and only exists so long as it is individualized, a temporary or at least a temporal becoming. Or else we conceive of ourselves as someone who supports or causes the individualization, an immortal being perhaps, but limited by its individuality. This perception and this conception constitute our ego sense. Normally, we go no farther in our knowledge of our individual existence.
So here he is probing the question as to whether the individual is the ego. Is our individuality bounded by what we might call a separative self-experience? We have an experience of ourselves in which we are the center of the cosmos. We are subjectively cut off from everybody else, and everybody else is in relation to our individuality. This itself is an entrapment. And this entrapment is something that we would like to be rid of. So it seems to be rational and reasonable to suppose that this is our individuality, and that this, if it was got rid of, then this would be the end of our individuality, if this separate entrapment in self-experience is no longer there. That's the end of the individuality. It's interesting to see, and so this is how Sri Aurobindo sets up this as the limited understanding of the individual, which is bounded by the ego. It's also interesting to note that when he talks about the dissolution of the ego, he points to certain instances or certain possibilities. Said, the transcendence of the ego, if there is the transcendence of the ego, the individual would abolish his own existence. This supposition, our end would be to disappear and dissolve, what is called laya, into some universality of matter, life, mind, or spirit. And this is, I found this very interesting, because Brahman is present at every level of consciousness. And it is technically possible for a laya to take place into the experience of Brahman in matter, or the experience of Brahman in life, or in mind. At each of these levels, there can be an experience of Brahman. In fact, Purusha at each of these levels is in contact with Brahman at that level. And one can, in fact, dissolve the ego at any of these levels. In fact, that's the experience that Bhrigu starts having in the Taittiriya Upanishad. He does experience Brahman at each of these levels, but he's asked not to stop there. Again, it's a similar experience to what we were discussing regarding the Nirvana of Sri Aurobindo. There can be other kinds of experiences of Brahman, like these experiences. And at each stage, we may have such an overwhelming sense of truth, because ultimately it is an experience of the infinite, that we may think that that is the only truth there is. But in the Upanishads, this is partly the reason why he's told that he has to rise beyond the avidya, beyond the entrapment of Purusha and Prakriti, in a kind of sleeping habit pattern, until it arrives at complete freedom and self-consciousness, total consciousness. In this integral and total consciousness, it will then see that these other forms of the Brahman are self-limitations of the Brahman, cosmic or universal self-limitations of the Brahman. However, it could also go beyond, and that's the last of those choices that he's put over there. Spirit would be here Satchidananda, or else some indeterminate from which our egoistic determinations of individuality have started. Maybe it starts in the unmanifest, which is the avyakta, beyond the Satchidananda. And it is there that we must completely dissolve ourselves, as in the samadhi of nirvikalpa samadhi. So these are all possibilities of moksha, of merging with certain infinite forms of infinite consciousness, out of which no individuality may return. And he's saying that the ego can certainly dissolve itself in one of these. The question still remains, was that what the individual was in the first case, or was the individual something other than, something greater than what we experience as ego? And then he goes into an analysis of ego and makes the assertion that it is a, it is nothing fundamentally real in itself, which is the ego, but only a practical constitution of our consciousness. Now, I recollect that Dan, when he read, used the word construction. I'm wondering whether that's in your texts, because I have a very old edition here. It is nothing fundamentally real in itself, but only a practical constitution. Does it say constitution or construction there?
Construction.
Okay. So that is certainly a change. In other words, it was...
Constitution.
Pardon?
The version I have says constitution.
What about the version on the net?
Mine is a PDF and it says construction.
So that must be a revision, which it's happening, because a lot of these terms, once they were subjected to image processing, they've turned out to be different from what they were originally seen to be. So if it is nothing fundamentally real in itself, but only a practical construction of our consciousness, devised to centralize the activities of nature in us. So here it is. It makes more sense, actually, a construction of our consciousness, because indeed, as he points out, there are all these different discontinuities of consciousness that exist within us. The physical, the vital, the mental, the psychic, the higher planes that are still latent, they all coexist in us as in a bag of different kinds of consciousness which are not continuous. They are cross-linked through the inner being, but they are not continuous. So to allow us to have a kind of practical sense of being someone, consciousness constructs a surface person, which is the ego. And so he says, we perceive a formation of mental, physical, vital experience which distinguishes itself from the rest of being, and that is what we think of as ourselves in nature. So individualization of being in becoming. Okay, so this is a provisional and empirical construction, what we call our ego. It doesn't answer the question as to whether there's something more permanent that we can call an individual behind it. And so this is what Sri Aurobindo feels at the inception, and problematizes the notion of individual as ego, which is an assumption in many spiritual paths.
I think if you read that with the term constitution, it kind of gives it a different meaning.
But if you see it as constitution, you're saying?
Yeah, because if you see it as construction, it's all involved with the process. Where you see it as constitution, it implies there's something more than just the process. That the process is there, but the constitution part of it also has connection to what is not individualized.
Yeah, but here he's talking about the ego, see. He's not talking about the individual. He's discussing what is the strongly separative self-experience that we call ego. And that doesn't have that deeper connection. The ego is by its nature exclusive. And hence, it stands largely by its sense of separation from others, equally by its sense of separation.
I'm going to reserve my judgment on that one. See what happens later on, because I don't think it. Well, yeah, talk more later.
Sure. I mean, he's defining ego as the sense of separative self, a sense which includes its separation. You see, the ego is something that can be porous, and maybe there can be a kind of an ego that transforms itself. But so then the definition would be different. But as he defines it, the ego is a sense of self that at least partly rests on its sense of separation and kind of empowers that, you know, that it is exclusive from others, not an inclusive separation, but an exclusive separation. So, but yeah, I mean, we can have other ideas of the ego, and we can kind of see what is possible, again, in the same way as he is himself doing, and we can re-evaluate that position.
I'm going to assume, I haven't read it all yet, but I'm going to assume that this chapter will go into a lot more about that as
sure.
we move through it. So
sure. But even more important, I think, for him is to go a lot more into what is the individual. Of course, the relation of the individual and the ego, but the individual is not the ego. This is the point he's making over here.
But there's also that question of the dissolution of the ego.
There's the question of the dissolution of the ego.
I've always thought that there's some value in the ego, that if it's completely dissoluted, I don't know if that's a word, but this, you get what I mean, that is lost. If there's no way to get value out of the ego in individuation.
Yeah, but it may have a temporary value. See, the point is that the individual, as he's defining the relation between individual and ego, has the true value of the ego. With the ego, the value of the ego is in its self-perception. It is in the fact that it's a unique perspective. The uniqueness of the ego belongs to the individual. But the sense of separation of the ego, the power by which we empower our own existence by putting down others as if they don't belong to us, it's not me, not me. That is the power of separation of the ego.
Right.
And that's the part.
That's what needs to be eliminated, right?
Exactly. So if that is eliminated, then for him, the ego is eliminated, but not the individual. That's the point. It's a question of semantics here, how we define these things. You know, every vocabulary has its own way of describing things.
So, I guess then the question that I still have on it is where he talks about the individualization of being and becoming.
Right.
So and that he's attributing to the ego. Is what is created, at least in part, through that process.
Yeah, if that is all there is to it, the individualization of being and becoming, if ego can be described as that in its totality, then yes, there is value to it. But I think he'll point out that the individualization of being and becoming is actually, in its truth, the psychic being. This exactly is how he describes the psychic being, the individualization of being and becoming. A projection of that onto the surface of the mental, vital, physical consciousness gives us a illusory sense of separation. But in itself, that does not have that sense of separation. So that is what he'll get into a little more later.
Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Okay.
So shall we break here for today and resume next time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. We'll resume 2 weeks from now. I guess that'll be the 22nd.
Yes, and I will be seeing some of you next weekend, which is the special weekend of the Darshan, both at Lodi and hopefully at CIF. I'll be coming up on Friday and stay through the weekend.
Looking forward to that, Debashish.
Definitely looking forward to that, Debashish. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, see you then.
All right, see you then. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Devashish. Good night.
Thank you. Good night. Thanks. Good night. Thanks. Bye.